Thank you, AJ. I want to call special attention to the opportunity that we have to participate in the gift that we'll share with the victims from the Paradise Church of Christ who were devastated by the campfire. By next Sunday is your chance to give, participate with that giving that we'll send from the Harvest Excess as well. It's been a blessing to share some in the 21 days of prayer across Fresno and Clovis. This has been an ongoing thing for several years that churches from around this area have an evening gathering. And I know that I'm representing our church at a couple of these. I'll go tonight to our closing one at Cornerstone Church downtown. We'll welcome anybody. But it's kind of neat to see our name, our little name, College Church of Christ, there among all of these churches from across town that are participating in this somehow. You know, we really do need others. The Paradise Church needs us. We need other churches here in town locally. We really do need others. And that's what I want to talk about today, is about the need that we have for others. When God made us, or when God made man, because that's how the narrators tell us the story began. When God made man, God saw that man was alone. And for the first time in the story of creation, God saw the man was alone and said, "This is not good." Something wasn't good, and what wasn't good was aloneness. And so this caused God to create the animals, and one by one he paraded the animals in front of the man, and the man named all of the animals. But none of them was found to be a suitable partner for the man. It wasn't until man was put to sleep and the rib was taken and woman was made that we had a helpful partner, a right partner for the man. The biblical writers often noted our need for connection. Paul said it like this: "Let love be genuine. Hate what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with mutual affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not lag in zeal. Be ardent in spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in suffering. Persevere in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints. Extend hospitality to strangers." Loving relationships isn't all there is to the Christian life, but loving relationships are at the heart of the Christian life. If you want to experience what it means to follow Jesus, then you must experience connection with others. And the challenge with mental illness, and specifically, and anxiety generally, problem is that these things separate us from what we most need as human beings. We need relationships. We need love. We need contact with other beings. There are other barriers to relationships. Somebody recently posted about how they had seen a sign in a restaurant that said, "We don't have Wi-Fi. Pretend it's 1994 and talk to each other." Of course, I would say, "Haha, I have LTE. I have 5G. We have so many barriers to meaningful connection. People sit in restaurants, parent and children, and the parent will be on the phone while the children are sitting there across the table. Or you'll see parents, the first thing they do sometimes is hand the kids a phone to distract the kids so the kids will be entertained while the adults get to eat. We put barriers all around us to relationship. We need interpersonal contact. But one of the biggest barriers is natural to life itself, and that is the barrier of anxiety, and then within us, mental illness that springs up, sometimes unexpected, within people's lives. I've had such great response to this series on faith and mental illness. People from my distant past have reached out to me with sharing stories. There have been people in town who don't go to our church who have talked to me. There have been our own church members who have wanted to share and talk. This week, one person was sharing with me about their struggle with anxiety, actual anxiety disorder. And although they are pretty well balanced now with medication and counseling, it still is a struggle to try to overcome the anxiety that prevents this person from getting the things that they need. You know, even like, even though they're in a good spot, it's sometimes anxiety-inducing to try to go meet me or somebody else to talk about things, even though we need those things. Mental illness and anxiety can be a roadblock for us to receive what it is that we most need. So this morning, I have a little testimonial to share. It's a celebrity testimonial I've invited, and this person has accepted, thanks to technology, a way of sharing the story. This is the story of Kevin Love, who is an NBA basketball player. He was a star for many years at the Minnesota Timberwolves, and then joined the Cleveland Cavaliers alongside LeBron James, where he won a championship ring. In November of 2017, Kevin Love had an experience that he has openly shared about and will share with us this morning in this video. Something happened on the basketball court that was the culmination of a number of things in his life. Listen, if you would.
You know, it's interesting when you have an injury, so to speak, and you have a knee injury or my hand or, you know, it's an ankle sprain. It's a lot different when you can't see it and somebody doesn't know what's going on outside the lines. Everybody's going through something. Success is not immune to depression.
So, Kevin, you are now the new face of mental health in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
How does that feel?
At first, it was a little scary. I think from you know, suffering with anxiety and depression for a long time into having my first panic attack on November 5th and not really knowing what that meant to fast forwarding being here now, it's changed my frame of mind, and I really do believe in writing my piece that everybody is going through something. So knowing that it doesn't discriminate and knowing that I'm trying to change the stigma, not only for, you know, people in sports, but all over. And I remember talking to my agent and he said, "Are you sure you want to do this? Because a lot of people are going to talk about it." I said, "Jeff, I don't know if anybody will, but, you know, just understand I'm trying to help people." He goes, "I get it. If you help one person, if you help one kid, it could be absolutely life-changing and groundbreaking for that kid."
Let's talk about the panic attack for a minute, because that's when the world got a little glimpse of what was going
yeah.
on. So take us through what happened that night.
Well, it was very scary for me because I have always had the anxiety, and like a lot of people, when, you know, either it's like, you know, for example, you want to go to bed and or you want to go to sleep and you think, I have a big game the next day. And so what happens? You know, you plan your routine, you try to go to sleep, you get ready, and then you dig up the worst things that have happened the last 10 years for you. So I think it was a combination of things that were going on in my life that led up to that point, as well as it was a 5-7 start. And on November 5th, I just remember not quite feeling right. I remember we went through a few plays. There was a timeout. I got to the huddle, and that's when I felt something that I had never felt before. I couldn't catch my breath. You know, I felt like my mind was completely out. And Ty Lue had said something to me. I told him I'll be right back. I ran in the locker room. I was essentially searching for something that I couldn't find. I didn't know this feeling. And then I just basically ran to our trainer's room, fell on the ground, collapsed, and, you know, my heart was jumping out of my chest, and I couldn't get air to my lungs, and, you know, essentially was you know, trying to clear my throat, sticking my hand down my throat, trying to get myself
Seriously?
Air. Yeah, so it was...
You must have been terrified.
It was terrifying. I thought I was having a heart attack. I really felt like I was going to die in this moment. I get like I'm getting hot thinking about it. It was a moment that nobody wants to have, but it was very eye-opening. And then going to the hospital after that, everything checked out, and I was basically thinking to myself, well, what happened? I've now come to a point where I just kind of lay all my cards out on the table and say, this is what you get. And having that freedom of mind is something that I've never really had. It's actually given me peace. And sometimes things get worse in order to get better. Sometimes there is a rock bottom, but I know that you know, people reaching out for help or talking to someone, it does really work. And for so long, I put that off, thinking I didn't need it, because that was my playbook when I was young, is to suppress it and, you know, be a man. And, you know, I think the masculinity thing is a, you know, kind of misleading in a lot of ways, because when that's ingrained in your mind in an early age, you feel that way throughout. You know, I wish I would have had the presence of mind earlier on to face these things. But sure. I think everybody has their moment, their aha moment, or that moment where, you know, they're able to come forward with these type of things.
So now I'm going to ask you what everyone wants to know. What's LeBron doing during this time?
Well, I remember the first thing he said to me after that came out was that, you know, he shook my hand on the back of the bus and, you know, kind of let everybody get off. And he said, you really helped a lot of people today. You helped a lot, not only a lot of kids, but you helped a lot of people. So that was a special moment, but, you know, I couldn't go a few minutes without another person in that community I talk about coming forward and saying, hey, this is my experience and I want to share this with you. So it was a way of seeing a lot of people are being vulnerable, mm-hmm. and also, you know, sharing these experiences and having that community and saying we need to beat down this stigma together.
So stigma is still the problem. There's still plenty of guys that have issues, and they don't need to come forward to me or to you, right. But they do need to get the help. But there are players out there that think you're soft because you did this. They think DeMar's soft. They're going to think everybody that comes forward is soft. What do you say to them?
Like, it's such a tired statement. Like, I've put my time in this league. Guys put their time in this league. To be in the NBA, you're not soft. And to come forward with this, it's, like I said, that's tired. It's outdated. And it actually, in the end, is probably, for me, it was the best thing I did, and it's only going to help you moving forward. And it doesn't just mean basketball players or anywhere in sports. This is an everyone and every human thing.
What a powerful story. And I hope it gives you some glimpse into the challenge of anxiety disorders and the challenge of anxiety in general. And so talking about worry and about anxiety leads us down two parallel paths. First, there's those who are dealing with a clinical anxiety disorder, mental illness, like Kevin. And folks in this situation need more than just simply love. They may need medication. They may need counseling. They may need some help to get on a stable place. But once you're at a stable place, even with an anxiety disorder, you must make healthy choices that prevent triggering new attacks. Now, this might include eating better. It might include a regular sleep schedule. It might include exercise. It might be knowing your triggers and being careful to avoid things that are going to stress you out. It's just like a person who goes and finds out they have high blood pressure. You're going to have to make some changes in order to avoid a major heart attack, right? You're going to have to eat less salt. You're going to have to change some of the things that you do and how you exercise. Same thing is true with mental illnesses. We've got to watch yourself beyond just simply getting to a level place. But also, those of us who may not have a mental illness or an anxiety disorder must still work to protect ourselves from the anxiety of our world. We live in a world that wants you to worry. And the failure to protect yourself is neglectful at best and sinful at worst. In Amy Simpson's book, one of the books we have for sale in the lobby, just because I want people to have resources you can take home and study yourself, in her book, Anxious, Choosing Faith in a World of Worry, she lists some of the ways in which our self-feeding culture of worry seeks to conform you to its chaotic rhythms. And this is her list, and I'm adapting this list somewhat, but some of these I have on this little pink sheet there in your bulletin if you want this. I think I left a couple of blanks just to make you work for it. But otherwise, they're there for you. But the first one she mentions is manufactured worry. There are powerful people who want you to worry, who want you to believe there are crises, who want you to feel like the world is falling apart. Why? So that you will support them, so that you will vote for them, so that they will have your attention and money. There are advertisers who get your money by making you think, oh my goodness, I have to have this. My life's going to fall apart if I don't have this. It's manufactured worry. There's work and school worry. Good workers, good students can help but worry about making good grades, about performing well on your job. It's just simply natural to want to do well. There's parenting worry. Can I get an amen here? There's parenting worry. New York Sun columnist Lenore Scanese gave her 9-year-old son a chance to find his way home in New York City on his own. The son was asking, Mom, what if I'm lost in the city and I don't know how to get home? Can you give me a chance to be able to go home from someplace? And so, sure enough, she gave her son a subway map, a metro card, $20, and a few quarters in case he needed to make a call. This was several years ago. And left him in Bloomingdale's with instructions to go home. He made it home just fine. And she wrote about this in her New York Sun column. She was accused of being a child abuser. The paper was berated for her actions in this. I mean, you can imagine, right? How many of you would do this for your 9-year-old child? But hey, I mean, I'm telling you, it worked out. And the child felt so proud that he could navigate the subway system on his own. He was so excited that he had done it. But parents, boy, we worry about everything. Or then there's civic worry. We worry, oh my goodness, about the shutdown. It just has driven the news. I mean, it's a big deal, I get it. But we're so worried about national news, things that we can't even control. How many of you pay attention locally to the city? I mean, that's where we really make a difference. But I mean, we worry so much about things that are happening in our world, it just drives us. Then there's TMI worry, too much information. We have so much information. I've heard the stat shared that there is more information in one edition of the New York Times than a person in the pre-industrial era would have ever been exposed to in their lifetime. We have so much information about what's happening in our world, it's mind-blowing. You're getting stressed out right now as I'm sharing this. I know, I can see it on you. Right? I feel stressed. And then there's the worry of social media. Social media doesn't help us feel more connected. It stresses us out often. I mean, maybe it does help in some ways, but it's not just fake news and fake images and crazy memes that people post. It's the conversations that happen that are just, there's people that I used to like until they started being total jerks on Facebook. I mean, really, seriously. And then there's the image that we have to portray out there. Everyone's smiling, everything's happy, 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 happy. Then there's celebrity worry, the people that we idolize and look up to. They want us to pay attention to their causes right and left so that they will stay famous and stay in the news. And we listen to them. And there's legal worry. I mean, folks are so concerned about liability and lawsuits. There's choice overload worry. Why does there have to be 700 cereal choices? Right? I mean, it's just so much. Do I really need all of these choices when I can't watch one thing on TV? I mean, come on, can you help me out here? I mean, 700 channels and there's not one thing I want to watch? I mean, come on. Then there's good Christian worry. And I don't mean that good Christians should worry. I mean, we worry about being good Christians. Am I doing the right things? Am I giving enough? Am I faithful enough? Am I leaving a church that's healthy for the next generation. We worry about these kinds of things. And these worries just cover some of the worries that our culture feeds into us. There's financial worries. There's FOMO worries, fear of missing out. There's all kinds of things that trouble us. The Apostle Paul has told us not to be conformed to the worries of this world, but to be transformed. He said it like this: do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, so that you may discern what is the will of God. When you go with the flow, when you allow the anxiety-inducing mania of our world to suck you in and conform you to itself, I don't care if you're recovering from an anxiety disorder or if you're just someone who is going through life, the obvious default choice is to live an anxious life. But how do we instead be transformed so that we don't live according to the world's crazy cycle? Well, so anxiety blocks us from seeking what we most need. And of course, proper diagnosis and treatment are vital components of therapy and pastoral care. Some diagnoses are clinical conditions. You may need to go see your actual doctor and get something prescribed to help you over a hump, or maybe long term. But there are other diagnoses that have to deal with deficiencies in our relationships with God and with others. Paul Preusser, a clinical psychologist who's written a lot of things for pastors, he has listed 7 concepts that help diagnose our anxious souls. And Alan Cole, in his book, Be Not Anxious, describes these 7 categories, these 7 concepts. I'm not going to go through these. They're here on the sheet. And on the back, I've created an exercise that if you want to go through this week to help take inventory yourself, this is what this is for on the back, is to look at these 7 in your own life. If you want to come and talk to me about some of these things, let me or let a pastor, a trusted person in your life help diagnose for you some things that may be growth areas for you. I encourage you to do that. But I know that there are things that we need, to realize in order to help us get past the conforming pressure of this anxious world. One of the things that we need to realize is that God is present. God is present. There is nowhere you can go to escape God's presence. Whether it's the darkest place, whether it's the brightest mountaintop, whether it's the belly of a whale or even death itself, you cannot get away from God. Even though there are experiences and situations in life when we feel abandoned by God, the reality is expressed in the words of David in Psalm 23. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. Why? For you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You even prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You've anointed my head with oil. My cup overflows. But there is no place in this life, not even in the enemies of the anxious world, you are not alone. God wants to provide an abundant feast for you. But yet we allow ourselves to be conformed by the pressures around us. And so we think there's a scarcity in front of us. That's why Jesus came. Jesus, Emmanuel, God with us, to demonstrate God will never leave us. And so we need to remember and drive it into our minds, even when we don't feel it. Keep these words near. God is present. But here's the second truth that we need to realize to help get us through. Second truth is that others would be present. There are people who would be glad to be with you in your most anxious moments. There are people. Not everybody wants to share equally in everything you go through, but there are people who will be present for you. We're really missing Brian McDougall these days. He's been 10 days in the hospital. And I'm sure, without speaking for Brian, that he's had some dark moments. But I also know that Brian has been so encouraged by the number of people who have come through his hospital room. I mean, I can't keep count, and I try to keep tabs on these things, just not them counting, but I pay attention. It's unbelievable how many people. But sometimes you have to give permission for others to be in your life. Sometimes people get the message that you don't want anybody, that you want everybody to stay away. And when you send that signal, guess what? People listen. But what you need often is, maybe it's one person, maybe it's 20 people. But you have to ask. And when you do, I've learned, others would be present. And we as fellow ministers within a church who want to turn outward to our community and to one another, we minister to others by being present. And how? How can we be present to others when they're going through life's darkest moments? Brené Brown, we have one of her books out in the foyer, but she's spoken about the difference between empathy and sympathy. And this is very important to realize as we think about how to be present with others. We have just a short clip from one of her talks.
So what is empathy, and why is it very different than sympathy? Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions, where empathy is relevant, and came up with four qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment, not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space when someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, you can climb down. I know what it's like down here. And you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh. No, you want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time, because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So I had a miscarriage. Oh, at least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. at least you have a marriage. John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
Two different people shared this video with me this week. I just had to use it. It fits so perfectly. You absolutely need connectedness. God wants to connect. We're here because we want to connect, I think. And can we be a church that is willing to connect? We have to realize that what's not needed in our world is churches that say, ooh, we can fix you. Instead, we need to learn to say, I'm so sorry. How can we be there for you? I know what some of you think. It's our job to fix the world. But I would reply, no, it's not. It's our job to be witnesses, to be present, to find within us that way in which God is connected with us, so that we can be a voice for those who also need to feel connection. So we're moving into our response time. I want to invite some individuals who have talked about going to the back this week. We'll be back by the sound booth. If you want to go back and receive an encouraging word, a hug, or not a hug. We believe the words of James when he said, are any among you suffering? They should pray. Are any cheerful? They should sing songs of praise. Are any among you sick? They should call for the elders of the church and have them pray over them, anointing them with oil in the name of the Lord. So we're going to enter into this time of prayer and confession while our praise team sings this song. And you can certainly join in the song, or you may just want to go to the back and receive prayer. Just know that the loving touch of a brother or sister or a loving word, if that's what you need, please get beyond yourself and ask for that today. Won't you respond during this song?